Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of President Obama's national security team as the U.S. faces multiple international crises. David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy magazine and author of the forthcoming book National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear, joins us to answer criticism that the president is not sufficiently engaged and that he does not have the counsel of seasoned foreign policy professionals as relations with Russia deteriorate to a dangerous level, with Putin trapped in a volatile situation in Ukraine, where unless there is a diplomatic intervention, the military situation could explode into a wider conflict. Then we'll examine the military situation between Hamas and Israel as fighting continues with little hope of a diplomatic solution from talks underway in Cairo that Israel is not a party to. Daniel Byman, a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution and author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism, joins us to discuss the much lower threshold of military success that Hamas has compared to Israel, and that the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas is already the biggest loser in the conflict so far. Then finally, with the Congress recessed for the summer break after a last-minute display of legislative dysfunction, we will speak with a veteran House and Senate senior staffer, Mike Lofgren, the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss why political posturing for House Republicans is preferable to legislating, and that as they return to their gerrymandered districts, incumbents are less likely to face the indignation that most Americans feel about our broken government in Washington. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who is the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making, Power, Inc., and his latest book forthcoming is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Good to be back.
And the president on Friday at a press conference was asked by a reporter if he'd lost influence around the world. And the president said that, you know, diplomatic efforts take time. And he said he was making progress pressuring Russia to resolve the Ukraine crisis. It seems to me that pressuring Russia itself could be the problem. Perhaps Putin has put himself in a trap, and if he, the only way out of that trap is for him to go to war in Ukraine, that's not progress.
No, that's certainly not progress. You know, I think the president has put himself in a bit of a trap, too. You know, he started out with the audacity of hope and a first year in which he went around the world outlining massive changes that he would help to lead in terms of the way the world worked. So expectations were set very high. He then discovered that foreign policy is hard and that the president of the United States' power is limited. And he also was constrained by his own impulses and those of many of his supporters regarding use of American influence around the world. And year after year, expectations got lowered to the point that he spent much of the past year just trying to tamp down expectations, saying we need our foreign policy is only going to hit singles and doubles. Our foreign policy is about not doing stupid stuff. Foreign policy is messy was one of the things that he kind of said on Friday. And essentially going around with the message, I can't have much influence. And, you know, if that's your message, you're not going to have much influence.
Well, I'm worried, David Rothkopf, about a dynamic that this is being driven by hawks on both sides. There clearly are hawks to the right of Putin, and while I don't think he cares much about international condemnation, he's basking in national adoration. Nevertheless, if he sells out his proxies in Ukraine, the hawks and most of the country will be bewildered, and the hawks will come after him. And, of course, we've got people like John McCain on our side talking about boots on the ground, NATO boots on the ground in Ukraine. So how much are the hawks in ascendancy in this dispute with Russia over Ukraine that could already some people say we're back in a Cold War, which I would think any statesman would consider that the greatest loss of progress in decades, as opposed to just blithely accepting it. But it's even more outrageous the notion that we could stumble into some kind of hot war.
Well, first of all, I don't know if hawks is exactly the right language that I would use. I think the reality is, although there are some hawks around Putin and that Putin himself is rather hawkish, that he is tapping into Russian nationalism and the fact that this is a country that for the past 20 years has been told, you used to be a superpower, you lost, you're down on your luck. And, you know, we saw what happened in Germany and in other countries that have fallen onto hard times after having been in an influential role in the past, and I think we should have been a little bit more aware of the desire for retribution and reascendancy that this provokes in a country. So I think it's nationalism that's driving a lot of Putin's popularity at the moment and driving his actions. I think here, while there are some hawks, very few people are calling for boots on the ground. I think the area where the critique of what the president and the West has done is probably more useful to listen to, is more towards the center, because the president and many of those in Europe have taken a kind of a very soft-pedaled path, micro-sanctions, narrow sanctions, broadening into somewhat less narrow sanctions, but still no real harsh pressure on the Russians. There's clearly division among the EU. There's clearly an unwillingness of the United States even to sort of symbolically, you know, state that you know, that we have a strong interest here to suggest that there is a military alliance here that's going to draw a line someplace. And so I think the question in the West is not how hawkish we are, it's how potent we are, how impotent we are, and what tools we have at our disposal to influence Putin. Thus far, you know, Putin's had a pretty good time of it. You know, he went into Crimea and took a fairly large chunk of land of strategic value. Not a shot was fired. He's been backing effectively an insurgency in eastern Ukraine, and even with the atrocity of the Malaysian airliner being shot down and so forth, the pressure on him has been economic and fairly narrow, even if it's had some, notable consequences.
But surely, David Rothkopf, Putin, of course, has made NATO into this huge juggernaut moving east, and there's no question that it has. But whether or not it's a juggernaut, I think, is a real question. There are no tanks now. The U.S. doesn't have any tanks in Europe. Remember the Fall the Gap and all of that idea of the Russians barreling through. It seems to me to be a fiction largely on paper. So how do you counter that myth of Putin's of encirclement? And not that Russians don't feel it. It's real to them. But on the other hand, if you look at the correlation of forces, et cetera, and Russia's new hybrid warfare of military force, covert action, and disinformation, apparently there's a NATO study that Russia could take the Baltics in about 2 or 3 days. So, and there's not much we could do about it. The Polish foreign minister was caught recently secretly on tape basically saying that NATO is worthless. So how do you navigate between those two realities?
Well, I think the thing that, you know, NATO's got a few problems right now. One, it's an old alliance that really hasn't been revamped. Second is, it's an alliance that was designed to deal with Cold War realities and the threat, you know, essentially of global thermonuclear war or total war for Europe. It doesn't really have a middle game. You know, it doesn't have the ability to do smaller activities within Europe, either, militarily or politically. It requires a degree of consensus that makes it extremely hard to do that kind of thing. And of course, most of the things that we are likely to face in this era are not global thermonuclear war. They're not total war across Europe or world war. And so we need to have tools that serve our middle game needs better, and we don't. We don't have them diplomatically. We don't really have them economically. We don't have them militarily. And so NATO is not a great deterrent, and the proof of that is, of course, that Putin took Crimea. He's active in Ukraine. He in 2008 did the same thing effectively in Georgia, in two parts of Georgia. I'm not 100% sure that we, should. In fact, I don't think that we should expect that this is going to end here. He's winning in his effort to reassert Russia's influence over its near abroad.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine, and his latest book coming soon is International Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. And apparently NATO at least has admitted to, at least the British leadership in NATO has admitted to it, deficiencies in NATO and Russia's new assertive use of this form of hybrid warfare of military force, covert action, and disinformation. But they added to that also cyber activity or cyber warfare. And Russia's already used that in the Baltics and apparently are very, very skilled at cyber. But still, we get back to, in that menu of deficiencies that you just gave us, David Rothkopf, one was diplomacy. And that is where there's a lot of criticism lately of the White House, that there aren't wise men, there aren't seasoned voices. He's not getting the counsel of people of experience, elder statesmen like Henry Kissinger, etc. And President Obama is surrounded by what critics say are a group of lightweights. Do you share that belief?
I certainly think that the Obama administration has gotten weaker over time rather than getting stronger over time. You started out, you had Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, Bob Gates, David Petraeus. You had a bunch of senior people, Tom Donilon as the National Security Advisor, who was, would sort of offer contrarian voices and strong voices that might offset those of the inner circle around Obama, who came from a different political view and were not deeply seasoned in terms of a lot of these international issues. And those folks are gone. And whereas some of the names that have replaced them have a lot of experience and history, they have not been welcomed into the inner circle, and they've been given missions that effectively keep them out of it. John Kerry, for all of, I think, his tireless, creative, tenacious efforts to address these issues around this world, has, because there's so many problems, turned into a kind of a human pinball, and he's bouncing from crisis to crisis to crisis, and is not at the center of the deliberations closest to the president. Chuck Hagel is not at the center of the deliberations closest to the president. And so you do have a group of like-minded people. One of my friends who was very, very high up within the Obama administration calls them the true believers, who, go to the president and say, you were elected to get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. You were elected to keep us out of problems like this. Let's avoid risk. Let's keep our heads down. Let's, not get engaged. And they have him leaning slightly backwards. None of these are bad people. None of them are, seeking to undercut U.S. interests. But their view is more disengaged than engaged. And the result is, a problem, because the United States is the world's last and sole superpower. The United States is viewed as the leader, and when we don't lead, that in and of itself sends a message. The alliances and the international institutions of the world are built for the United States to have to take an active role for them to work. We designed them that way. And so when we don't, they don't work. And so we get ourselves into a position where we seem passive because we are passive. We seem disengaged because we are disengaging. And the views within the White House are not diverse enough to cajole the president into other kinds of action. And frankly, he's not seeking out other views. He is not a manager who empowers his team and makes it bigger and broader. He prefers a smaller group, and he prefers to stay more aloof. He doesn't have a lot of international relationships at a high level. And many of the relationships that he did have been damaged by events, whether it's the upheaval in the Middle East or it's the NSA scandal. And so you've got a kind of a president in a bubble who's isolated from the rest of the world, who's surrounded by a group of people who may be well-intentioned but who don't offer a very diverse range of views, at the center of a country that's hesitant to take action. That's not healthy for the world, and it doesn't advance U.S. national interests in the way that they need to be advanced.
David Rothkopf, on Friday, the president did say he had yet another long conversation with Vladimir Putin. Apparently, they talk a lot on the phone. Whether that is the result of a close relationship, as some people have suggested, or that, as Angela Merkel once indicated, that Putin just keeps saying the same thing over and over again, and it's almost next to impossible to change his mind. My understanding is that, to some extent, the president has outsourced these major theaters, in the case of Russia, to Joe Biden, and in the case of Israel, to John Kerry. And that's in stark contrast to his predecessor, George W. Bush, who really believed in personal relationships. However, he chose some of the worst people to have relationships with, Hamid Karzai and Maliki in Iraq. So how do you steer a middle course between having not so much being able to put your arms around somebody and say, this is my new buddy, and that guy turns out to be useless, on the other hand, being aloof and disengaged?
Well, I don't think there is a middle course. I think you do have to engage. I think being aloof and disengaged never works. I think when you are engaged, at least you have a chance of persuading people, even if they're not good people. And remember, some of the people that we have to deal with in the world, whether it's Putin or, you know, Karzai or Assad, are people that are, you know, are bad people that we don't want to deal with and we would prefer weren't there. But short of replacing them, which we can't do in many, many cases, we have to deal with them. And so, and the president has a unique role in having to deal with these people. His relationship with Putin is super tense, not constructive. These men do not like each other. And anybody who suggests anything to the contrary is not paying attention to the facts. You know, you mentioned George W. Bush, you know, I think through the course of his presidency, after starting out ghastly wrong with regard to Iraq and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and the Patriot Act and a whole host of other things, he recognized a lot of that wasn't working. He changed his team around in the second term. He brought in some different voices. He got rid of Rumsfeld. He dialed back Cheney. He changed people's key roles. He brought in Gates. He brought in Josh Bolton as chief of staff. He brought in Hank Paulson to handle the China relationship. And he himself got more engaged. And you can take the Maliki case, and clearly Iraq is a mess from beginning to end. But there were 2 years of comparative stability in Iraq, and those 2 years came at the end of the Bush administration because of, A, the surge, and, B, the fact that the president of the United States was so engaged in this that he would have a weekly conversation with Maliki, and he really managed the thing. When Obama came in, they said, do you want to keep having these conversations? And one of his aides said, no, that would be demeaning of the presidency. Well, there's a cost to that. You know, and so, you know, I don't think George Bush is ever going to get an award as the best foreign policy president in U.S. history. But the personal diplomacy he did, whether there or with the big emerging powers around the world or with some of our allies in the Gulf, really did make a difference and did have a stabilizing effect.
Well, I think your point, David Rothkopf, that we deal with difficult people, and once you get through condemning the young leader in North Korea, you know, you still got to deal with him. So it would seem that this is a real problem in the sense that the world has some incredibly bad actors who can cause great harm, and you simply can't wish them away. My fear is actually the world is actually getting worse. We thought that Al-Qaeda was pretty radical. Now IS, that controls a big chunk of Iraq and Syria, they've pushed the envelope even further. So the trajectory that we're on is that the bad guys are getting badder. So doesn't that require some kind of international organization, a leadership, not in the way that George Bush did the war on terror and was unilateral, but in some multilateral way?
Absolutely it does. And I think one of the things that we ought to recognize is that the United States became the sole superpower in the world and was able to ultimately defeat the Soviet Union in the sort of struggle for power in the Cold War years by building a series of alliances and institutions that went with those alliances that is unequaled in the history of the world. And we still have more alliances on paper than any other country on the planet Earth by a long shot. But, you know, having an alliance on paper and making it work in reality are two different things. And a lot of these, as we talked about earlier with NATO, are focused on the problems of the past and not the problems of the future, and they need to be updated. At the same time, they always depend on the collaboration among the leaders. You know, you had Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin getting together during World War II, despite deep differences, to manage their common interests where they aligned and to try to tamp down the differences where they had differences. You know, when you see a group like ISIS and you don't want to put U.S. boots on the ground, and by the way, there are some scenarios where we would have to. If ISIS went into Jordan and was approaching Amman, and we thought that Jordan would fall, the consequences of that for Israel and for the Gulf would be so great, I suspect we would have to take some kind of an action. But if you want to avoid that, then you have to have alliances and partnerships on the ground. And, you know, in that part of the world, where there is a kind of a struggle right now between militant or political Islam and more moderate forces, and that has manifested itself in Libya, in Egypt, in Gaza, in Syria, in Iraq, and so forth, we have to recognize that there are forces who are on the other side of that, and they themselves are disparate. It's Israel and Egypt, Kuwait, Saudis, the Emiratis, Bahrainis, Jordanians, and so forth. Well, we, in the course of the past couple of years, have managed, by virtue of our disengagement, to alienate virtually all of those people who are the most vital allies in containing the threat of groups like the Islamic State. And we need to say, it's time for a strategic look, it's time for new alliances, it's time to reach out and revitalize the partnership that gives the voices of moderation and the voices of progress within the Islamic world a chance to overcome those whose vision for the future looks a lot like the 8th century.
Well, just in closing, David Rothkopf, the end of the Cold War arguably was one of the great achievements in modern history. Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev ended decades of a hair trigger in which the whole world could die within 30 minutes and every American city would be vaporized. So that is a major achievement. And the idea that we're in a situation now where some are blithely saying that the Cold War has returned, that should be, if it's true, if there's any truth to it, should be one of the greatest tragedies of modern geopolitics. So, and then on top of that, the idea that things are so dangerous now between Russia and Ukraine that something's got to intervene there to stop that war from becoming wider and hotter. So is that, do you think that is worth discussing? It would seem to me to be, in the overall scheme of things, a real tragedy to have blithely accepted that the Cold War is coming back.
Well, it's always worth discussing because you don't want it ever to come back. Having said that, I think upon careful analysis, we'll see that in the first instance, Russia today is not the Soviet Union. It's economically devastated. It's faced a demographic crisis unlike that faced by a lot of other countries. It's very dependent on resources and therefore trade with the world that could, if it wanted to, really put the squeeze on it. It does have nuclear forces that are greater than any other country but the United States. But, you know, mutually assured destruction is still a pretty strong deterrent. It worked pretty well during the Cold War. And the likelihood that Russia would utilize that power against the United States when it would mean its total devastation is still fairly low. The question is what happens in the middle, as I said earlier. The question is, you know, can Russia go and reach out and in the territories near it without being counteracted, and what's that going to do to the relationship? And even in this case, I think while it's alienating and I think while it's going to lead to more sanctions and it's going to lead to more tension, we need Russia to reach a solution in Syria. We need Russia to reach a solution in Iran. And whatever our tough rhetoric, I suspect behind the scenes, John Kerry and Sergey Lavrov, their foreign minister, are talking a lot about these other kinds of issues. And so we're going to continue to work with them. The result is it's not the Cold War. It's not a small Cold War. It's a different kind of major power relationship. And if we really want to offset it, we've got to do two things. We have to restructure the Atlantic Alliance and get something functional out of our dysfunctional EU partners in this, because that's one of the problems. And we have to recognize that whether it's in this issue with Russia, or in the Middle East, or in Africa, or in Asia, or anywhere in the world, we have to have a new kind of working collaboration with the Chinese, who are the rising number two power in the world, and have an interest in stability, and have a lot of influence, including over people like the Russians. And unless we are coordinated with them, as we've seen with the sanctions, we are not going to be effective. So we need a new kind of diplomacy, new kind of institutions, a revision and a forward-looking reassessment of our strategies, and then I think we can put to rest the idea that we're going to be returning to a Cold War.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who's the CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, Superclass, the Global Elite in the World They Are Making, Power, Inc. And his latest book out soon is National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how in the Gaza conflict, Hamas has a much lower threshold of military success than Israel does. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now, Daniel Byman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
And when Prime Minister Netanyahu recently addressed the Israeli people and said this will be a prolonged war with Gaza, and more or less implied that for once and for all he was going to sort of settle this problem, so as to speak, obviously there was a ceasefire and that lasted for 2 hours. And then, again, Prime Minister Netanyahu appeared to be very angry. He told the American ambassador that, essentially, don't bother us with these kind of things. You know, don't impose your Hamas-driven ideas on us. And he was quite angry about it. And now they're resuming the fighting. But at what point will Netanyahu be able to deliver, if indeed this wasn't an overt promise, but it was, I think, an implied promise?
Netanyahu's in a tough spot because the only way to really destroy Hamas once and for all is to occupy Gaza. And doing so would be a massive military effort that would take months, if not years, and would involve a constant campaign against Hamas fighters. And Israel has no stomach for that, and it's not even clear that it would work. But if Hamas is not destroyed, then Israel has to worry that there's going to be a repeat of rocket attacks or use of tunnels, things it's very concerned about, and that's going to continue indefinitely. So either way, it's going to be hard for Netanyahu to have the victory he wants.
And in terms of diplomacy, is there any active diplomacy given the annoyance expressed by the Prime Minister of Israel, implying that the U.S. was, rather than being constructive, was meddling?
There are certainly attempts at diplomacy. There is mediation going on in Egypt. There's talks by various officials at different levels. There's an attempt because both sides recognize that the situation could be worse as well as better, but it's very, very hard because the death toll on the Palestinian side makes it very hard for Hamas to pull back and give in the face of Israeli pressure. And from Israel's point of view, as long as rockets are going on, as long as they feel there's a continued danger, giving up would be a political defeat. So for both sides, their own domestic politics make it very hard to come to a deal.
And Prime Minister Netanyahu is not sending a delegation to Cairo.
To my knowledge, that's correct.
So do you think then that this international condemnation will weigh in if, you know, the rest of the world, when you've got people like the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, condemning these attacks on the schools where Palestinian civilians are essentially seeking refuge, his condemnation was incredibly outspoken. Is that likely to, the accumulation of that, short of U.S. diplomacy and efforts in Cairo, how much do you think that that weighs on Netanyahu?
By itself, the international condemnation doesn't weigh much. Israelis have a longstanding and at times quite deserved suspicion that the U.N. is biased against them, and their skepticism about Europe as well. However, many Israelis do care about international opinion, and there is a concern that the country, for various reasons, is becoming a pariah state. But for most Israelis, the million-dollar question is, what do the Americans think? And as long as they feel they have U.S. support, or at least are not acting in the direct face of U.S. opposition, that's the most important factor when they consider the diplomatic climate.
And do you think that, that there's any indication that the U.S. may shift in that regard? I certainly don't see anything, certainly not in the Congress and not in the White House, in terms of any split with Israel. However, one doesn't know exactly what goes on in these conversations, do we?
Well, I certainly don't. In terms of what we see in Congress, I think there is likely to be no change. Congress is going to be strongly and vocally pro-Israel in this conflict. In the White House, what we've seen so far are mixed signals. There have certainly been public statements of strong support, but also, according to press information that's come out, there's been criticism of Israel. There's been statements urging Israel, at times publicly, to at least try to be more careful in its targeting. So there has been criticism, but it's been relatively muted, and I think the Obama administration is reluctant to go beyond that.
Now, just in terms of tactics, a couple of military analysts recently suggested to me that Hamas learned from Hezbollah in their war against Israel, and that there was a deliberate tactic to fire these rockets, even though they don't have much military utility, although they are a potent psychological weapon. At a point, if you keep firing them from tunnels, there isn't the advantages that Israel has with its air force, etc., neutralized to the extent that you can't really take these out, that you have to put boots on the ground to find these tunnels. And that is Hamas's strategy, to draw the Israeli defense forces, the military, the army, in to these narrow alleys, which they booby-trap, etc. And it does seem that casualties have largely resulted from drawing Israeli soldiers into these narrow alleys and these tunnels. And, of course, the tunnels begin inside houses, so they can't be seen from the air. So you actually have to send soldiers into rooms, which, in my understanding from talking to special forces people, etc., that's the last thing soldiers like to do, urban combat and room to room.
Hamas is trying to pursue a military strategy based on a political victory. So for Hamas, very important is being able to say that they are continuing rocket attacks, even in the face of Israeli pressure. So should there be a ceasefire, Hamas can say, we never gave in until the last second we continued firing. We had the option of going on, and we are standing up. So part of inflicting fear, inflicting terror on Israel from Hamas's view was a way of showing the people in Gaza that they're fighting back. The tunnels are also an important part of Hamas's strategy. It realizes correctly that Israel is an incredibly casualty-sensitive country. And so the tunnels allow Hamas fighters to emerge behind the Israeli forces to surprise them. And this has enabled Hamas to inflict casualties. It's also enabled Hamas to attempt kidnapping operations. And Hamas in the past has exchanged captured Israelis for over 1,000 in one case, over 1,000 of its own prisoners. So the possibility of a capture and the likelihood that they'll at least kill some Israelis has again enabled Hamas to say to its own people, we're fighting back. And even though the levels of casualties are tremendously skewed against Hamas. No one expects it to be even. Simply fighting back is some degree of victory. And to go further on this point, what Hamas is able to accomplish as well is that it's able to force Israel to risk its own forces to go into Gaza. When Israel does this, it has a very difficult choice, which is if it's going to go into buildings, if it's going to go into places like mosques and so on, where there may be ammunition, where there may be tunnels beginning, it's going to inflict casualties, and often civilian casualties, frequently civilian casualties. On the other hand, if Israel does not do this, it will not be as effective militarily as Israel would like. So Israel is given a very tough and difficult choice that's going to be criticized either way.
So in terms of Hamas being the only actor fighting Israel, is there any evidence that these more radical groups like Islamic Jihad are involved? Because there was a suicide bomber that blew up a couple of Israeli soldiers, one of whom was the lieutenant that for a while they thought was captured, but it turned out he died in that suicide bombing.
That's right. And we do see, certainly Islamic Jihad is also part of who is fighting the Israelis coming in. And it's likely that some of the other small groups, including some that probably have an ideology more akin to al-Qaeda than Hamas, that they've joined the fray as well. For any Palestinian militant group, you cannot sit this out, that when Israeli forces come in, when they're seen as invading Gaza, if you stand on the sidelines, you'll be branded as at least irrelevant and perhaps even traitorous. So they're all joining the fray.
So is this then, what is the end game here for, let's start with Hamas. I mean, they've stated that they want the blockade to end. And a big element in the blockade, of course, is cement. So what is it that they want out of this?
Hamas certainly wants the isolation of Gaza to end. And this is both an economic isolation and also a political isolation. Before this conflict began, Hamas was on the ropes, not just because of Israeli pressure, but also because the world was ignoring it. The coup in Egypt had meant that Hamas had lost an ally in the government there that had, in fact, turned into an enemy. So from Hamas's point of view, it wants more things that will recognize it as the de facto government of Gaza and allow it to govern. It has to be able to claim to Gazans and to its own fighters that it got something for all this suffering.
And what do you think is the end game on Netanyahu's side?
Netanyahu wants to be able to say that he set Hamas back and that he did so in a dramatic and decisive way. So this can vary. It can include things like destroyed rockets, destroyed tunnels. But it also has to be some form of deterrence, some form of saying that Hamas is so afraid of further Israeli retaliation, it's not going to do more attacks. So for Netanyahu to claim success, he not only has to end the fighting with some semblance of a deal that looks good for Israel, but also 6 months from now, 2 years from now, for Israelis to look back and say that the casualties they suffered, that was worth it.
Well, isn't that a pretty tall order? How much has he already promised in terms of settling this problem once and for all? Because I don't see the Israelis wanting to give Hamas a victory. And I guess the wild card in this is what happens on the West Bank. What about the Palestinian Authority? Don't they look impotent in all of this? There's obviously an attempt at a government bridging the gap between the PA and Hamas, a unity government. Israel was always against that. Where will that stand? I can't imagine that Netanyahu wants that to be rekindled.
There's one clear loser from all of this, and that's the PA and Palestinian President Abbas, that he is seen as negotiating with someone who is responsible for the death of many innocent Palestinians. And more broadly, the negotiation strategy is in tatters. Before the fighting began, the peace process, of course, collapsed. And Hamas and its model that it calls resistance, that's admired by many Palestinians. So Abbas is going to come out even weaker politically, which was hard to do given the weakness he began with.
So is there then another way to look at this, Daniel Byman, and that is that a victory for Hamas is a much lower threshold than a victory for Israel?
Absolutely. Hamas simply has to survive and be able to say it was successfully defiant and gain a few token concessions. Israel has to claim much more damage to Hamas and a longer period of calm. And that's in part why the violence and the suffering has been so disproportionate, because given Israel's casualty sensitivity, given its military superiority, both Israelis and Palestinians expect that the outcome will not be equal. So it has to be disproportionate for Israel to claim success, and the real question is how disproportionate.
So throughout the conversation, Daniel Bierman, we've talked about trying to understand what the military aspects of this conflict, and you've just pointed out how the Palestinian Authority under Mahmoud Abbas are the big losers here. So that on the diplomatic or loosely speaking, the peace side, there's not a lot of good news. But in all of this, is there, since we're talking about the stick and not the carrot, are there any carrots left?
Well, certainly there are carrots left that are possible. You could relax the blockade in Gaza. You could improve relations between the Hamas government and Egypt. You could make some concessions in the West Bank to allow Palestinians in general to have things easier. So there's certainly potential for carrots, but that's hard to do in negotiations after a significant conflict. It'd be hard for Israelis to say, yes, we fought so hard, and that's why we're giving them carrots. So the possibility is there, but I think in the short term, at least, it's unlikely.
But in terms of a unity government and Hamas dealing with the PA, it would seem that Hamas will be able to re-enter negotiations with the PA in a much stronger way, with a much stronger suit, wouldn't they?
That's absolutely right. Hamas was politically quite weak before this conflict, and now it's able to say that it's been defiant, it's been strong, and the PA, meanwhile, has looked rather passive. So relative to its Palestinian rival, Hamas is emerging stronger.
So is that to say then that a new unity government could take place and Hamas would be much stronger in this new unity government, and that would put Netanyahu's position even more in jeopardy, in as much as he's been against the unity government, against Hamas, which is labeled a terrorist organization, and if they come back stronger, if the Palestinians have a government that's more tilted with influence from Hamas, wouldn't that be a loss for Netanyahu?
It certainly would, although many Israelis are skeptical of the unity government to begin with. So from their point of view, the government already has too much of a Hamas presence. So even if this increases, they already see the unity government as fundamentally tainted.
So just in wrapping up here then, Daniel Bierman, what's your sense of where we'll be in a few months? Because if you look at the broader region, it's very obviously one of the things that I find extraordinary about particularly what's happening in Iraq and Syria is we always thought Al-Qaeda was pretty bad. But now there's something worse and even more radical, and that's the Islamic State. And the Islamic State now has put Jordan in a situation where both of its borders are controlled by incredible radicals. And that's Jordan is not a strong state to begin with. So if you broaden out from the Gaza situation to a more regional picture, things are incredibly shaky, are they not? And I would be concerned that Jordan is very vulnerable.
Certainly the region is quite shaky. And the good news on Jordan is that its domestic politics are more stable than that of many of its neighbors, and it has a very strong intelligence service and relatively competent military forces. So I'm not worried about the problems that have swept Iraq sweeping Jordan. At the same time, however, I am very worried about Lebanon. Lebanon is already very weak. It's already very divided. We've already seen violence from Syria spilling over into Lebanon. And certainly one of the legacies of the Arab Spring in general has been weakness throughout the Middle East, and there's a real possibility that that weakness may not only continue but may grow, and this is going to be a generation-long problem.
Well, Daniel Bierman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you again.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Bierman, who's a professor at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of A High Price, The Triumphs and Failures of Israeli Counterterrorism. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the legislative dysfunction on display in the House last week. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be back.
And Mike, it would seem that you're going to have to revise in a new edition of your book. It's not that the Republicans went crazy. They've gone even crazier, it would seem. The antics of the last few days of last week before they recessed on Friday for the summer are kind of surreal. You know, and one day they sue the president for overreaching on executive orders, and the next day, because of their dysfunction, they turn around and say, well, we're going on vacation. The president's going to have to fix the immigration mess with executive orders. Go figure.
Yes, it is rather bizarre. Now, I was made aware of a meeting of the Republican conference in the House the same week that the final vote was taken on the immigration bill, which, of course, was a dead letter. They simply voted, threw it into the Senate's lap, and went home. And there's not going to be any action taken on it because it was a purely symbolic vote. Now, in this meeting, many of the members were of the opinion, why should we have any vote at all, or even get our fingerprints on it? It's Obama's problem. Let him deal with it. It's going to be an election issue in the future. Let's just tar him with it and not sully our own hands. These are, of course, the same people who are denouncing him as a tyrant and King George III and all that sort of thing. So it's quite a contradiction.
But many of these conservative House members are crowing at a great victory of how they got the leadership to completely change the bill and move it way to the right. That's what Steve King is saying. Quoting him, we got a lot of very smart people in our conference, and when you sit down and work with them, you unleash that talent, you end up with a better product, and you end up with people who have ownership that want to promote it rather than those that feel essentially asked to go along. And then Michelle Bachmann is saying, what I saw in the last 24 hours is nothing short of remarkable. I couldn't believe it. Leadership was like, one is reasonable, number two is reasonable. It gutted the bill, changed the bill. So they're crowing about changing a bill, moving it way to the right, even talking about getting rid of the dreamers, the kids in this country, deporting the whole bunch of them. Are they totally oblivious of how this is going to play in the rest of the country, particularly with the growing constituency of Latino voters?
Well, of course there's that, but then they're caught up in the moment. What it harkens back to is after the 2012 presidential election, there was all this beard pulling and soul searching by people like Bobby Jindal and all the rest of the so-called, you know, reformers, that they were going to reach out to non-traditional constituencies, and to do that, they'd have to climb out of their shell and be more inclusive and all that sort of thing. Well, this particular vote shows that that's totally inoperative. It also shows that, yes, you can get to 218 votes in the Republican conference if you simply put together a bill that accedes to the demands of the most extreme members.
But this stuff is theater, though. None of this is, I mean, this bill that they wrangled over doesn't, as you say, it's a dead letter. It's not going to go anywhere. So do they do these characters on the Republican caucus and the Tea Party people, do they recognize an audience beyond their own in that chamber? In other words, do they recognize that somebody out in America knows that you guys are posturing, you're not legislating?
Well, they may at some level recognize that, but their jobs aren't dependent on what a sort of majority of the American people think. They're dependent on what a majority of their base in their gerrymandered districts think. Most of these people don't, you know, 95% of them or more, don't face any credible challenge in a general election. The only challenge they face is in a primary, as our now former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor found out when he spent the morning of the primary election on Pennsylvania Avenue, a couple of blocks from the Capitol, at a Starbucks talking to lobbyists rather than being in his district. And he got his hat handed to him.
So that is the ultimate reality, right? The primary and the constituency that's gerrymandered. So they're all in essentially in safe seats. The only thing they're not safe from is somebody further to the right than them.
Absolutely, that is the case. That explains this voting. It explains the composition of the legislation, and it explains all the posturing.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina relief, and debates on the Pentagon budget and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. So is this the problem then, Mike, that the House is just going to go further and further to the right? The Senate, which is more deliberative, they represent the entire state, since they have a broader constituency, not just the narrow gerrymandered district.
Right, you can't gerrymander a state, although I'm sure some people would try.
But does that mean then that, this midterm, there's no chance, of course, of the Democrats taking the House. Obviously, their efforts will be with the Senate. What's your sense of whether or not this immigration bill is going to work against some of these senators in southern states that are vulnerable, like David Pryor in Arkansas and Mary Landrieu in Louisiana?
Well, it is a rather potent issue in some of these states, and I wouldn't say, you know, you can entirely ascribe it to craziness on the part of the Republicans if, in fact, it's good electoral politics for the midterm, and their base tends to turn out in the midterm, which Democrats do not, as we saw in 2010. And the whole dynamic with the primary versus the general election, that's kind of rational politicking if you are a House member who only cares about maintaining his seat. That's kind of what you do in the crazy atmosphere of America circa 2014, is you just play to the most extreme elements because those are the ones who come out and vote and support you, or alternatively will punish you.
Well, of course, in terms of the immigration issue, Hispanics make up less than 3% of all registered voters. This is in 2012 in seven of these competitive Senate states: Louisiana, Arkansas, North Carolina, Iowa, Michigan, Georgia, and Kentucky. So that obviously the idea that this will backfire on the Republicans in those states, unless, of course, there's an uptick in Hispanic registration in these states.
Right. And I don't see that in the offing in the next few months. So, you know, it is at least a thinkable proposition that Republicans could gain the majority in the Senate. And when that happens, it kind of gives them a psychological boost. I'm well aware that you require two-thirds of the Senate in order to convict an impeached president. But don't think that this lawsuit that they're about to lodge against Obama isn't kind of a prelude to something like that if they get both houses of Congress in Obama's last 2 years of his presidency, just like Clinton's last 2 years of his presidency, they launched that impeachment thing.
So in other words, they won't be satisfied with making him a lame duck. They just want to totally eviscerate him.
Well, that movement has some traction among some circles in the Republican Party. And, you know, there's been some thinking that the lawsuit was kind of the preliminary opening shot. Most people think the courts will say, look, this is a political squabble between two branches, and if you want to remedy the situation of Obama issuing executive orders and you want to rescind them, well, just get the Senate to agree. This is a problem within the legislative branch. It's nothing we can solve, and it's nothing we're going to touch. And I expect, although with the Supreme Court's recent rulings, I can't be totally confident, I suspect that's the way a court would rule, and they'd throw out the suit. And given the dynamic, some Republicans would say, well, that leaves us no recourse but to impeach this tyrant.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mike Lofton.
You're quite welcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Lofton, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina relief, and debates on the Pentagon budget and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.